Welcome to Democratically 2020, the podcast all about the politics, policies, and personalities of the 2020 Democratic primary. I'm your host, Karen Robinson.
So I am thrilled to welcome onto Democratically 2020 an old friend of mine and brilliant man, Simon Clark. Simon is many things in his varied life, but one of the things he is the chair of an organization called Foreign Policy for America. Which is, I'll let you tell us a little bit more about it, but it's an organization trying to kind of build a community around foreign policy specialism. But Simon is just generally one of the smartest people I know about making the party work well and making politics work well. And especially, we're here to have a little chat about the world of donation and giving and how people should think about money in politics and think about giving to politics to have the biggest impact for their money. So, Simon, welcome.
Karen, thanks so much. It's so great to be on your show.
It is delightful to talk to you. It's always delightful to talk to you. Now, listeners should probably know the backstory of how Simon and I knew each other way back in the glory days, which is that when I was a field director for the Obama campaign, I launched and ran our campaign office out of his London basement. So we go way back.
If I remember rightly, you had more than 20 lines going and volunteers coming in and out every moment.
It was a busy time, and you were very patient with all the people traipsing through your downstairs basement. So thank you for that and for all the other ways in which you've helped the party and me personally over the years.
Well, that was a joy. But I do have one anecdote, which I thought I would share right at the beginning. So last year, my daughter was volunteering for the Warren campaign. You won't be surprised. And she was carpooling up to New Hampshire one weekend to go to some Warren event. Started talking to a young woman who was going to University of New York. This young woman asked my daughter where she was from. Sophie explained that she'd grown up in London. And this New Yorker said, "Oh, London, do you listen to Karen Robinson's podcast?"
Oh, you're kidding.
It's amazing. Sophie, slightly surprised, said, "Not only do I listen to the podcast, but of course I knew her when I was a child." And she said, "Oh, she's wonderful." And turned out this woman had never been to London, had no UK connection at all, was very seriously engaged in US politics, and everybody in her dorm at her university follows you. So you have fans.
That is amazing. That is the rare independent evidence of an actual audience base out there. So to you, young lady, wherever you are, thanks. Thanks for listening. That makes my day. So listen, we should talk about the thing we're here to talk about today, although I could talk to you about many things anytime. But the genesis of this conversation was, I'm thinking about giving some money for the campaigns this year, as I do every election cycle, but it's time for me to start thinking about how much I can give and where I want to give. Obviously, the Biden campaign is going to be near the top of my list of who should get my money. But people often ask me, well, where's the most effective place to put your political donation? Who is it, a campaign? Is it an organization? And I thought rather than just me try and figure that out on my own, it would probably be worth us having a conversation about it. So I think let's just start with the kind of big picture storytelling. People think about political donations as if it's something that, you know, the great and the good do, that there's this kind of elite niche of givers. And to some extent, that is partly true. But actually, the role of smaller dollar donors in the party has gone up drastically in recent years, hasn't it?
Increasingly, it's less important. I mean, yes, of course, there's still the Georgetown cocktail party circuit, which everybody loves to complain about. And trust me, I've been to a few of those cocktail parties. The drinks are terrible. But it doesn't matter that much anymore. And increasingly, it is the enthusiasm of small dollars that is important. American political donations are regulated by law. And so there are limits to how much each person can give. There are ways around those, which are, of course, legal. But it's worth understanding that there are maximums that people can give. And therefore, small dollar money and the enthusiasm around it has become increasingly important. Why? Of course, because of the internet. The internet has disintermediated political giving, just like it's disintermediated everything else. But crucially for campaigns, the difference between somebody who gives $30 and the person who gives $2,800 is that you can go back to the person who's given $30 and ask them to give more. At $2,800, that person is pretty much maxed out. They can't give any more by law to most campaigns.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got a kind of a resource that you can tap into again and again. So I guess what I'm trying to say is to my listeners, actually, even if you can only give $5 today, $5 tomorrow, you know, $10 next month, it all adds up. And cumulatively, if everybody does as much as they can, the impact could be potentially massive.
Yes, I think only is the wrong word. I mean, giving and not giving is the interesting question. Being involved and not being involved. Yeah. The quantum is what you can afford, and that's fine. That depends on your own circumstances. The real choice is being involved.
Yeah, make a decision to be a donor as opposed to a sideline on the sideline. Exactly. And I think that's the other thing, is one of the things that's come through in the political science literature, I think, has been enthusiasm as it manifests itself in any way is valuable. So if enthusiasm manifests itself as giving $5, that often translates into that $5 donor also going out and spending some time volunteering. That volunteer also might give again. The person who, you know, gave again then might come back next week. I mean, these two things are inextricably linked. We have to do both. Give of our time and our money, and some people have more of one than the other, but it's all good.
And this is something that you did so brilliantly in 2008. You built a whole group of Obama loyalists because you got them to commit to do something.
Yeah, literally anything. It's all about, you know, lowering the barriers, getting people to take that first step. And if $5 is what you can give, then it's great. Give it. We'll take it. It's fabulous. So obviously, you know, we've got a presidential election, but the presidential election is not the only game in town. And I think when I think about giving, especially, you know, if it's not because I particularly am enamored of a specific candidate, but because I want to think about my political impact, I always think in terms of how can I maximize the kind of political power and effectiveness of Democrats as a party and of the issues that I believe in. So I think that's the conversation I thought it would be helpful to have today, is I'm imagining, let's imagine I have $100 or $1,000 or $10,000, whatever, a fixed amount with a couple zeros after it, more or less zeros. And I'm trying to figure out where is the best value for money place for me to give my donation in terms of maximizing the impact that money is gonna have on making Democrats more powerful in the United States of America. And making progressives generally more powerful in the United States of America. So I think the first big question is, do I give to an organization or do I give to a campaign? What are your thoughts on that?
So you could give your first $620,000 just to the Biden campaign. Right. There is a Biden Victory Fund, and the campaign finance limit for that is $620,600.
Yeah.
So there you go. You could just pop it all in there.
Right.
Not a problem. That might be the right thing to do, because that goes to the Biden campaign, to the Democratic National Committee, and then down to all the state parties. However, that might not be the right decision for you, depending on what your priorities are. And so then you really have to start thinking about what it is that you care about, and frankly, how much work are you prepared to do? To decide where to give. Let me give you an analogy to investing. You might decide you've got your $10,000, $100,000, whatever it is, that you want to invest in the stock market. Mm-hmm. You could choose individual shares in companies that you know a great deal about and want to follow, or you could put it in a mutual fund.
Right.
And let the fund manager decide where to put it. You could put it in an active mutual fund where a fund manager makes decisions. You could put it in a passive one where it just follows an index, right? These are all decisions about how much work you want to do and how precise you want to be in your investing decisions. If you think about political donations as investments, you're not going to go far wrong.
So I think that's a really interesting analogy. So by that analogy, is the DNC like a passive mutual fund?
No.
Is it an active mutual fund?
Not even. The DNC is a decision. That is an investment decision.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what the committees do, because I think it's important, and it's easy to misunderstand the role of the committees. It's an odd structure. So we have three major federal committees. There's the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic Senate, and the SCC, and the Democratic House Committee, the DCCC.
Love these names.
Or D-Trip, if you want to really sound as if you're in the know.
If you're super cool, it's the D-Trip.
The Senate Committee and the House Committees choose the candidates who they think have the best chance of winning. Mm-hmm. But they make selections very much on the grounds of who can deliver a majority in the House and Senate, respectively, and funnel the money that way. Some of the money, of course, has to stay behind to manage the organization, but fundamentally, those are mutual funds in our analogy.
Got it.
The DNC is very different. The DNC builds a national party. The national party has its own responsibilities, providing, for example, cybersecurity consultancy to all candidates, providing, for example, messaging advice to candidates. But what it does not do is to support individual candidates, with the one obvious exception of the presidential candidate.
Got it. So the DNC is infrastructure, basically.
Correct.
Right. It's building.
And that's what you're investing in. Now, I feel very sorry for my friends who do a lot of fundraising for the DNC, because it's always harder to get people to invest in infrastructure rather than invest in an exciting candidate or what unfortunately drives most so much of the funding decisions, investing against the candidate you hate.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we'll come on to that a little bit, I think, when we talk about individual candidate fundraising. Because I think one of the things that often happens is that people, as you say, they decide they really hate Mitch McConnell, so they're going to throw Amy McGrath a lot of money, which may be the right thing to do. It isn't necessarily always the best ROI in terms of victory per dollar spent, but I'm not going to discourage anyone from throwing any money against Mitch McConnell if they want to.
but the fascinating case study on that is the difference between the amount of money Beto O'Rourke was able to raise in his race against Ted Cruz, right? Essentially unlimited amounts of cash, and the tiny amounts of money he was able to raise for his presidential run. Now, whatever you think of his presidential run, it wasn't that Beto suddenly became a terrible candidate, having been a brilliant candidate. Yeah. The mobilization clearly was mobilization against Cruz.
I think the mobilization was mobilization against Cruz, and also that when he was running in the primary, obviously in the general election, he'd get whoever he gets against Trump, but in the primary, the people he was mobilizing against was other Democrats. So, it's you're making a choice that way. Okay, so if I want to invest in a committee, the DCCC or the DSCC, they really make it easy with these names, don't they?
Don't they just?
So they will be the ones who will be selecting candidates based on a kind of investment calculation of where's the best place for them to put their money. So if you don't know enough about the Senate to feel confident in choosing a candidate, maybe the DSCC is the place to go.
Absolutely. Although you could make the argument that given that there's a fairly limited number of Senate races, you should educate yourself, that that's something worth doing. Clearly, the House races are a little bit more complicated. There are 435 of them.
Yeah.
But there is another alternative as well.
Go on.
Which is that you can talk about whatever the area of policy is that you're most interested in and support an organization that is active in that area. Let me give you an example. The League of Conservation Voters creates effectively a political home for people who care about environmental issues. By doing so, they are able to mobilize environmental voters and donors and get the attention of the politicians they're able to support. The League of Conservation Voters raises money for candidates. It brings volunteers out to knock on doors for candidates. Obviously, that's going to be virtual this time around. Mm-hmm. And then it helps candidates think through their own policy positions. It clearly is going to support candidates who are environmentally conscious in the first place, but there's always detail, and LCB is there to help.
Right.
You were kind enough to introduce Foreign Policy for America at the beginning. We do exactly the same thing for people who care about America's place in the world.
Right. So the Foreign Policy for America, are you picking and choosing candidates to support them on the basis of their foreign policy thinking?
We are. So what we do is we select candidates on the basis of three criteria. One is, do we align with their, or do they align with our view of America's place in the world? Mm-hmm. Do we support international aid, more diplomacy, less war, funding the State Department properly, getting rid of the global gag rule, which is a nightmare, and a number of policy issues. We look at for people who are in tough but winnable races. There's no point supporting people who have absolutely no hope, but equally, we're not going to take up our members' energy supporting people who have an easy walk. So we're trying to find competitive races. And we're very proud of the 19 people who are in Congress who we helped get in there last cycle, and there are a bunch more that we're going to help get in this cycle. And then, and this is really important if you understand the mechanics of American politics, we are supporting people who want to be on the committees we care about, on foreign affairs, on intelligence, on armed services, and so on. And the reason for that is there's very little incentive for candidates to want to serve on foreign relations committees. Mm-hmm. You serve on banking, you serve on agriculture, you have unlimited fundraising opportunities.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to talk to you, people will give you money to be able to talk to you. That's not true on the committees that deal with America's place in the world. And yet, those are the most important committees of all. We want to make it easier for people to serve on those.
Great. So that's adding a really useful lens into it, which is raising the importance of specific sets of issues within the party and within the country. So, you know, you might pick somebody who's doing fantastic get out the vote and activist work and supporting candidates, but with a mind towards wanting to elect candidates who will help be not only better advocates for those issues, but also making those issues more themselves more prominent, more salient in the American psyche.
Like, exactly, which is why I said at the beginning, it depends, because it very much depends on what is it that you care about as an engaged citizen, as a voter, as a donor, as an activist.
What do you think of organizations that are not directly party organizations, but do a similar GOTV type job, such as I'm thinking of people like Flippable or Indivisible or Swing Left? There are a lot of organizations out there. What's the ratio of, you know, what's the value add of giving to one of them versus giving to a party or a candidate?
So I'm enormously impressed with what those organizations have done and the energy that they brought to the job of mobilizing votes. So again, you should feel comfortable with the organization you want to support. But as a general point, these new organizations have refreshed what had become quite a stale playbook. And it brought new ideas, new energy, new vigor, and frankly, also a welcoming home in places where the official party sometimes felt like a closed shop.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point, because one thing I know very well from my many years of working within the party is that to a lot of people, for good reasons and bad reasons, the party can, as you say, come across as a closed shop, but also the party has to do a lot of work that prevents them from speaking out or being vocal in particular types of ways. Indeed. For example, the party can obviously get involved in the primary process because they have a role in running it. Now, if you are somebody who feels strongly that you want the party to move in one direction or another, the DNC, the DCCC, and the DSCC are not going to be able to help you do that because they have to support whoever.
What's more, they will put a thumb on the scale for the incumbent.
Yeah, they will try. Yeah, they are effectively, and you know, this is sometimes right and sometimes wrong, but they are effectively mm-hmm. a trade body for incumbents, members of Congress.
And it's important to understand that. That's not a criticism, it's just a fact of life.
It's their job. Yeah. Great. So those other organizations are good, but they don't build longstanding party infrastructure within the party. So again, there's a trade-off, isn't there?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's clearly a need for party infrastructure.
Yeah.
And that's why the DNC exists, and it's a really important organization. But increasingly, the swing lefts of the world have been building parallel and importantly, compatible infrastructure. So rather than trying to compete with the local party organizations, they've worked with them while trying to keep a separate identity. I think that's actually very positive.
Yeah.
So I don't think of them as fly-by-night organizations at all. But the party still matters.
Yeah.
It matters because there are laws that say the party can do certain things. It matters also just on a very practical level, because when it comes to advertising, the official campaigns get much, much better preferential rates from TV stations.
That's a good point.
So when you're thinking about, is my money being used intelligently?
Yeah.
Giving to a party is much more effective than, for example, giving to a super PAC.
Yeah. Yeah. So from an ROI point of view, assuming that the ads are equally good, the, you know, a candidate, a campaign committee can go further with it potentially.
Correct.
But then the ads may not be equally good.
Right. Typically, a super PAC will pay 3 to 4 times the price
right.
of the candidate for the same amount of airtime on a TV station.
Oh, now,
Having said that,
because I'm super stingy.
Yeah, 3 to 4 times. I mean, it's a real difference.
Yeah.
And a bunch of Republican super PACs have fallen into that trap and wasted an enormous amount of their donors' money, which makes me very sad.
Oh, poor Republicans.
Now, let me say one thing about the Republicans, though, which I think is a very interesting phenomenon this cycle.
Yeah.
I've got to know these people, so a bunch of them have become my friends since I moved to DC. There have been some extraordinarily principled and brave Republicans who turned against this president and his hangers-on in 2015, in 2016, and stuck with their principles. It lost many of them their jobs. It lost all of them their friends. And I have nothing but respect for these groups that have stuck with what they believed in.
Yeah.
As a result, organizations like the Lincoln Project and Republican Voters Against Trump, and there are others, yeah. have real credibility in the 2020 cycle, being able to speak to people who voted for Trump in 2016 and don't feel comfortable doing so this time around. The number of people they need to talk to are not big, but they could well be decisive. And so I think it is quite an interesting project.
Yeah, I agree. They're a really interesting project. We actually covered some of that last week when we talked about advertising, and we looked at one or two Lincoln Project ads because they are making fantastic ads.
Oh, their ads are so much fun. But I'd actually encourage you to look at the Republican Voters against Trump ad as well.
Yep.
The ads are not slick.
Yeah.
At all, and deliberately so. They are Republican voters speaking to camera, usually on their cell phone, about why they voted for Trump in 2016 and why they can't bring themselves to do it this time around. They're extraordinarily effective.
And it's a really interesting one because, as you say, they are allies for this election cycle. I mean, God willing, we get Biden into office and then we'll see if we remain on the same side as each other, but they might play a very valuable role in this election cycle in particular. So that's also something to factor in.
Okay. They all say that they're looking forward to the day when they can be attacking us again.
I know. I'm looking forward to disagreeing with some of these people again. Respectfully and kindly.
Indeed.
Okay. So great. So I've got advocacy organizations. I've got candidate committees. What about actual campaigns? What should I be looking for? Obviously, assuming that there's a candidate that I like, let's say I want to figure out whether the candidate has a good chance of winning, whether the candidate is going to spend my money wisely, and whether the candidate actually even needs my money. Some campaigns feel really flush with cash, and maybe you'd be better off giving to somebody else who's a little bit, you know, a little bit more in need. So how can we figure these things out?
So let's take those in turn. The first question, how do we, let me get them right. How do I know the money will be spent well? The big question here is the candidate running a good campaign?
Yep.
Part of that you can get a sense of by just looking at the press. Politico does very good, very detailed reporting. You will notice the same names coming up again and again because they're clearly running a good campaign. Yeah. I have a personal bias on this. I get the standard fundraising emails that I fear we all get. And when they read like everybody else's fundraising email, that suggests to me that at least the finance team is not running a good campaign.
Right.
So see how they communicate with you as a potential donor. Are they
Do you have any red flags? Are there like phrases that you read in an email where you instantly think, okay, they don't know what they're doing?
Oh, it's more than phrases. There are templates.
Yeah.
Because remember, these are written by consultants.
Yeah.
And it's the same small number of consultants who write all of them. When you can't tell where the email came from without looking again at the name at the top,
yeah.
you know that this is a cookie cutter campaign. That is a problem. Yeah. So the other area is, does the candidate speak to the needs of the district? Does the candidate have a connection to the district? Can she say, not necessarily, I've lived here all my life, although that can be a very good thing, but is there an organic connection? Does it make sense for that candidate to be involved? And then to your question about will the money be spent? Well, that's a bit more complicated because some races are simply more expensive than others. It very much depends on the media market you're covering. Yeah. And it's worth either having a conversation with the finance team to understand what the budget is for the campaign, how much they've raised so far. These are all things they can tell you. And why the budget is what it is. But also take a look, and again, all of these numbers are online, thankfully, these days. Take a look at what previous campaigns have cost in that district, and of course, what the opponent is raising. Yeah. Those are all useful tells. But in the end, this is, and I think should be, an emotional decision, not just a purely Bean County one. Yeah. Are you excited about the candidate? Are you proud to be able to say that you support candidate X? Do you like telling the candidate's story? These are all, I think, very powerful suggestions that you're on the right track.
Yeah.
I can give you the Alyssa Slotkin story or the Abigail Spangler story or the Tom Malinowski story all day long.
Right? Yeah.
Because I'm really excited about having supported them and supporting them again.
Yeah. And you won.
And we won.
So who are you excited about in this election?
My number one pick right now is Cal Cunningham, who's running for Senate in North Carolina.
Tell me more about him, because I know very little, except that I knew that the North Carolina Senate seat was potentially competitive, but I'm embarrassed to admit I did not know very much about who was running in that seat until I heard that you were supporting Cal Cunningham. So tell me.
I'll give you the Cal Cunningham story, and then I'll give you the reason why I'm so excited about it. So Cal is a soldier, former soldier. He's a lieutenant colonel in the reserves. He served as a JAG, so as a lawyer in the army. Mm-hmm. His job in Iraq and Afghanistan, for which he won numerous decorations, was prosecuting fraudulent contractors, finding the crooks and putting them in jail. And by the way, that kept him extremely busy. And he now still does his Army Reserve service, which he spends at Fort Bragg, the home of the Special Operations Forces, teaching ethics and the rules of war to Special Operations officers. So the man has a deep ethical core and a track record of serving the country. When he retired from active duty, he started an environmental consulting firm where he helps cities in North Carolina go green. Mm-hmm. So he helps them with the transition to a zero carbon environment and a logical, economically sensible way of making that transition away from fossil fuels. He's a North Carolinian born and bred, grew up there, lived there all his life. Oh. He sounds like a local, he is a local. He was in the State House, he ran for Senate once before, he knows the ropes, and he's running a good, solid campaign. He knows everybody. He spent time, of course, now virtually, but he spent time over the last couple of years touring the whole state. And North Carolina is a very interesting state. Mm. It's in many ways reminiscent of Virginia 10 years ago. It was one of those classic Southern states that was solid Democrat and then became solid Republican and then started changing. It became more educated. It became more welcoming to new communities and to immigrant communities. It became more prosperous.
Yeah.
And it's been a 50-50 state,
yeah,
really for the last few years, but heavily gerrymandered, heavily controlled by a particularly aggressive anti-democratic Republican Party that has tried to hold onto the state. That broke 2 years ago with the election of a Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, who's extremely popular and is going to win re-election I think very comfortably this year. And we now have a shot at the Senate seat. Now, why do I care about this, apart from the fact that I think Cunningham is a great guy and is running a really solid campaign? I care about it because this is the race that is likely to determine who controls the Senate in 2021. right? We're probably going to lose one, much as I adore Doug Jones.
Yeah.
We're probably going to win three,
yeah,
but we need to win four. And the fourth most likely, now we could win six or seven, right? We could get a lovely landslide and we'd all be happy. But what we need is four,
yeah,
if we win the presidency. And remember, if Biden doesn't have the Senate,
he's got nothing.
We're really going to struggle.
Because there's so much we have to do.
This is the seat.
Yeah.
That is the tipping point seat. So if you're thinking about where to invest your time, money, effort, energy, it's really hard after the Biden campaign, of course,
yeah,
to think of a more important race than coming up.
And of course, if you think in terms of, again, stingy value for money, North Carolina is also going to be an important presidential state, and the prospect of swinging it for the Electoral College would be really valuable. So, 50 work done for the Senate race there is also going to help. One would presume would help Biden as well, which is no bad thing.
Exactly right. And Biden is within the margin of error in the state.
Yeah.
And we've got the tailwind of a very, very popular governor who's handled the COVID crisis extremely well.
Yep.
But there's one more thing.
Yep.
Is this even more interesting? Tom Tillis, the incumbent senator, the man with absolutely no, has got himself stuck, mm-hmm, because he tried briefly to separate himself from Trump,
mm-hmm,
and he failed because Trump won't allow anybody to separate themselves from him. Trump is not a good enough politician to understand that. And Tillis was humiliated and had to withdraw his mild opposition to Trump and go back to full allegiance. As a result, not only did the independents desert Tillis because he was shown to be a man with no spine and no conscience, but 10% of voters who are absolutely going to vote for Trump in 2020 in North Carolina tell pollsters they will not vote for Tillis.
Interesting.
So you've got the added bonus of a Republican incumbent who's already lost 10% of the vote that ought to be in his book.
So are those, sorry, I'm just really fascinated by that. Those 10% presumably are not going to vote for Cunningham, but are they going to vote for the party? Are they going to stay home? What are they doing?
They'll vote for the presidential line.
Yeah. Right.
And then they won't vote down ticket. These things happen.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. Yeah, Trump destroys everything he touches. It's amazing.
ETDD. Everything Trump touches dies.
Yeah, there you go. He's got a reverse Midas touch.
I know. We have to give that attribution to Rick Wilson, who's a total genius.
Brilliant. Okay, so one other aspect that I wanted to talk to you about. One of the things we often talk about in this podcast is how far we allow ourselves to hope and dream, in the sense of, I have a big belief that you compete everywhere you can compete, that, you know, even in places like Alabama, where we didn't have an opportunity in the Senate race there until suddenly we did and Doug Jones won, that you need to go out there and compete. And there are some states like North Carolina that are in a, you know, just about to tip, you know, maybe we can hurry them along, et cetera. But then there are some states, like I alluded to earlier, you know, Kentucky, for example, which, you know, we're not going to win, but it would be nice to compete. And so I'm curious how you think about whether it's worth putting money to races that we expect to lose just because it's good to show up and compete.
Sometimes. So let's talk about that. Let's assume that you have a limited amount of money. Of course. If you had unlimited money, you should.
Everybody has unlimited money.
Absolutely everyone. But everybody's got some limitations. The first job we have is to win the presidential election. There's simply nothing more important than getting Trump out of the White House.
Yeah.
And even though I adore Cal Cunningham, if I had $1, I'd put it into the Biden campaign. Type two, I'd split them. The second most important task we have is to win the Senate. Without the Senate, President Biden is going to have a pretty miserable 2 years.
Yeah.
The third, of course, is to hold the House, and we have some wonderful candidates. We actually have a number of pickup opportunities. And then the fourth is to continue building a 50-state party, as Howard Dean used to tell us many, many years ago. And that's where your point comes in about competing everywhere, and I couldn't agree more. It's really important for us not to allow the Democratic Party to be pigeonholed as a coastal party or an elitist party or any of that nonsense. But then if you're going to do that, you want to invest in areas that are demographically trending in the right way.
Yep.
And where you have good leadership. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you a few examples. Wisconsin. Ben Wickler, who's an absolute star.
Absolute star. Love him.
We all adore. Was doing a phenomenal job at Move On in Washington. Everybody loved him. He could do anything he wanted. He was doing extraordinarily well. And he was very comfortable in Washington. So Ben left his comfortable job in Washington to return to his home in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and rebuild a Democratic Party that was dead. And we saw the results of a dead Democratic Party there in 2016, tragically. Ben has done a great job doing that and investing in a Wisconsin Democratic Party under that kind of leadership is a very good investment. Yeah. Equally, candidates like Gina Ortiz-Jones or Sri Kulkarni, who are working in Texas to keep picking off Texas seats, like Colin Allred did last time around in Dallas,
yep.
are doing extraordinary work, not just to win one more seat in the House, but to start showing that Democrats can compete all over Texas. And that's really, really important. Georgia, really important. Mm. There's a terrific Senate candidate in Alaska, Al Gross, independent,
yeah.
who have caucused with us, who is making the case over there. Where I don't think it makes a lot of sense to invest.
Yeah.
Is, and I don't want to sound cruel about this, but the vanity candidate, right? The candidate who does great national advertising,
yeah.
but doesn't have deep roots and isn't building an infrastructure. It's one thing to lose a race.
Yeah.
It's another to lose a race and leave nothing behind.
That's fair. And I think you touched on a really interesting point there, which is also worth calling out, which is that even in states where Democrats are not close to winning, there are parts of those states where we can do very well. So yeah. it might be
Oklahoma 5.
Yeah, yeah. It might be particular House districts or even local races. You know, I know you and I have talked before about building from the ground up, and there are Republicans started this way. I mean, they started 30, 40 years ago, rebuilding the party from the school board level, you know, up to city council, up to here, there, and everywhere. And I think, you know, we shouldn't discount anything in terms of that. So I guess that's another question I have is, how do you think about the role of these state and local state legislatures play a huge role in redistricting next year? From a political power point of view, how do you weigh that?
So take a look at Virginia. Virginia is a state transformed by long, hard political work. Virginia that has now passed the Equal Rights Amendment, that has brought in fair redistricting, that has brought in Medicaid for everybody. And these are phenomenal changes in a state where nothing had changed for so long. Why? Because the Democrats competed at state level and at local level all across the Commonwealth. Yeah. It's crucially important. And wherever your listeners live today, they came from a state once.
Yeah.
So getting involved in your home state politics, whether you are in the U.S. or whether you're abroad, and getting stuck into the state House of Delegates races, the state Senate races, the local races, is really valuable. And your money goes so much further.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of it. I mean, I get really excited about giving to local races when I can figure out the right ones to give to, because $1,000 means the world to a local state house candidate. They can really spend that money and they can spend it in really useful ways. It's the difference between being able to compete and win and not being able to compete at all in some of these races. And there are organizations, I think Flippable is doing some really good work on this. I think there's an organization called Future Now, which is focusing just on these races. A lot of people are starting to get that idea and actually starting to think about consolidating donations and distributing them to local candidates as needed. So that's another thing to think about. And at every election, there are always, even outside of federal election years, there are often really successful roles that you can play within local and legislative races, even at your city level. Plus, it connects you more closely to local democracy, which is no bad thing too.
That way you're not a hobbyist.
Exactly. It's
you're
real.
You're actually an activist. You're a real activist. Yes. By the way, one thing about these organizations that you mentioned is they do great work educating themselves about the state of the race, the demographics, the changes in districts. And they do this work because they want to be effective and have an impact. But they also do the work because the people who work there love this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They are very happy to share what they've learned with other donors. And you should use them. Talk to them. Listen to what they've got to say. Ask them questions. They're only too happy to share their knowledge.
Yeah, that's a great point as well. And let's be honest, when you donate to one of these organizations, you're going to be on their email list forever. But some of the email lists are really worth being on. You know, I get a lot of emails that I delete without reading. And then I get some where I just respect the organizations. I know that they're always going to give me something good. And as you say, they're often, these days, they're often running webinars. They're often sending out newsletters full of information or running podcasts like this one, you know, et cetera. So there's lots of information out there for the donor activist donor that we were talking about earlier. Fabulous. Simon, that has been really helpful for me. I really appreciate your time. Do you want to stick around for a few more minutes and we can play the gut check game?
Absolutely.
Fabulous. So for listeners new to the podcast, basically what I have in front of me is some little slips of paper that I'm going to pluck at random out of my trusty Red Sox baseball cap. And I will read them out and Simon and I will just react to them in real time. Now this week, I happen to have pulled some headlines from various different media outlets just to give us a chance to catch up on some of the news around the race. And I'm going to pull the first one. Oh, this is a really good one that made me very happy this morning. This is a headline from Politico. Poll, Biden up 13 points on Trump in Pennsylvania.
Well, the first thing you're going to say is, of course, a poll is just a snapshot in time. And
it's only one poll.
A lot of people are drifting away from Trump right now because he's been visibly incompetent and flailing. We don't yet know whether they will go back to him when the election narrows and comes up, or whether the bottom has fallen out, as the phrase goes. We just don't know. We have to assume that they're going to come back, and we have to assume that it's going to be a really tight election. We have to fight for every vote. If on November 4th, we've got a 13-point lead, then I'll celebrate, not a moment before.
I think that's all fair, even though you're a bit of a spoil sport, but all right. As Nate Silber would say, it's a snapshot in time, and you should look at the poll of polls, the average of all polls, rather than just individual polls, which can have their own inherent biases, etc. I think the only reason why I was particularly delighted by this was that we've been little light on Pennsylvania polls lately. I think there's only been one or two live voter polls in the past month or so. And I think one of the things that went wrong so for us in 2016 was that we had blind spots in places where we didn't have good data. So as much as the result, which I'm very happy with as a for the moment outcome, I was also just glad to see that somebody's polling Pennsylvania so that we're, you know, keeping a better finger on the pulse there, because it is a make or break state for us. It's not enough to win Pennsylvania, but we won't win without Pennsylvania.
There is one other aspect of this, which is the psychological one. The president and his minions seem to be obsessed with polls and bad polls. I notice now they refuse to look at the Fox News polls, which actually are very good.
Yeah.
And only now comment on the One America News polls, which are not quite so good. But it's leading them to make some very strange investment decisions. They're up on the air in the most Republican parts of Iowa right now. Now, either they are very confused or they are very, very scared.
Yeah, well, probably both. Also not that bright.
Yes.
I'll do another one. Here's one. Speaking of Trump being not all that pulled together. This is a headline from a Politico magazine article about Mary Trump's new book. Quote, he is and always will be a terrified little boy.
Malevolent, you could have put in there.
Terrified, malevolent little boy.
Yeah, that'll do. But it's not him, right? It's the machinery around him. It's an entire political party that allowed itself to be captured. They knew what was happening to them. And just listen to Lindsey Graham in 2015 saying that if Trump becomes president, we will be destroyed and we will deserve it. He was right.
Are you familiar with the Twilight Zone episode from the mid-60s that became famous after Trump was elected? I think it's called A Beautiful Life, something like that. But basically, I'm going somewhere with this. You'll see where it is very quickly. The plot of this episode of The Twilight Zone is that there's a seven or eight year old little boy who's basically omnipotent. He can do whatever he wants. He has all the power in the world. And because he's always been able to just make people disappear as soon as he has a toddler tantrum, no one's ever been able to impose any discipline on him. So his parents are terrified of him because he keeps making people disappear, and he keeps, he took the whole town away and moved it to a cornfield long ago. And so everybody's terrified of him. So nobody can ever say anything is wrong or bad, or you shouldn't do that. Nobody can ever call him out for his bad actions or assert that they are also important beings in the universe because he has all this power. Well, Trump is the kid, but the Republican Party is the magical power he's been gifted. He's been given this omnipotence, this great political power, in the form of a Republican Party that's handed over all of their will to him. And it's extraordinary.
And now it's too late.
No.
With the one deeply honorable exception of Mitt Romney,
yeah,
for whom statues will be built, they all quit.
Yep. Yep. I will never listen to anyone who is currently in Congress, any Republican who is currently in Congress, apart from Mitt Romney, lecture me about patriotism ever again. Because they knew it. They knew what they were doing.
They might not have known that the Russians had put bounties on our soldiers, but they've done nothing since it became public.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Once bitten, twice shy. Let's not give them a second chance. Here's a headline that touches on a race that we talked about earlier. Sessions loses runoff in Alabama as Trump helps vanquish a key supporter he came to despise. There's a lot going on in that Washington Post headline, isn't there?
Good headline. So it comes back to your earlier point about everything Trump touches dies. Yeah. Jeff Sessions gave Trump respectability when he had none.
Yeah.
Because, not because Sessions knew Trump or because there was any prior relationship, but because Sessions had spent his entire life looking for a candidate who loathed immigrants.
Yep.
And that's what Trump offered him. And Trump offered him importance when all his colleagues in the Senate despised him. In return, Trump destroyed Sessions.
Yeah.
Now, the reason the Alabama race is not a foregone conclusion, even though Alabama will, of course, vote for Trump in the general, is that nobody knows anything about Tommy Tuberville. And Doug Jones's team, which is a very aggressive team run by Joe Trippi, legendary political consultant.
We had him on the podcast a few weeks ago.
Trippi is fantastic. Is not shy about defining Tuberville.
Yeah.
And I would point you to some of the attacks that they launched yesterday and today. They're fierce and totally justified.
Yeah. Yeah. And Doug Jones, you were talking earlier about being a good fit for your district. Doug Jones has been a very good fit for Alabama. Not only, he did manage to win over a lot of kind of more moderate Republican voters in the last election, but also he had the credentials and the credibility to really bring out African American voters in unprecedented proportions. So let's hope we can do that again. So good luck. Good luck. Jones v. Tuberville, I guess we have now. We'll do one more. Here's one. Air Force veteran MJ Hagar wins the Texas Democratic Senate primary. That's a Vox headline, but it could have been a headline for many publications. Big news this week. What do we think of MJ Hagar?
Oh, she's terrific. She's a wonderful candidate. By the way, it was a good spirited primary. Both candidates were very, very good. And I'm glad the primary happened. And I think it makes the party stronger. Now, Cornyn is not loathed the way Cruz was, and so Hagar deserves more help than she's getting from donors and supporters. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy race, but she's a very impressive candidate. She's a vet. She's a wounded warrior. She would, if she elected, have the best tattoo in the Senate.
That's a whole new electoral criteria.
And the state is changing. Mm.
Until recently, the word I was hearing from Texas was Texas is changing. It's definitely demographically shifting in our direction, but probably not this election cycle. obviously Trump's catastrophic mismanagement of everything has perhaps put it at least in a more competitive direction. I guess, you know, one thing I would wonder about is, you know, first of all, how far off are we? And second of all, what's the demographics of the Hispanic, the Latino vote going to be in Texas and elsewhere? Democrats have been doing really well in some of the Western states, like Arizona, obviously is looking competitive this time around. But Trump does surprisingly, not well exactly, but less badly than you might expect with a lot of Latino voters.
Trump picks up to, what is it, 31% of Latino men? Those are big numbers.
Yeah.
Now, that might change because of the catastrophic mismanagement of COVID. And by the way, because of the state's own catastrophic mismanagement of COVID,
sure,
which is important. But what we find over and over again is the best proxy is education. And Texas is an increasingly well-educated state with people moving across the nation to Texas for good, high-quality jobs in the big cities. It is, of course, a complicated state, and with the media markets are very difficult, although it's really interesting that the Biden campaign is now on air in Texas.
Yep, as is the Trump campaign.
As is the Trump campaign. And the Trump campaign is showing signs of nervousness.
Yep.
Now, would you bet on Texas going for Biden in this election? No, you wouldn't, and the numbers aren't there yet. But stranger things have happened. If the bottom does indeed fall out of the Trump campaign, Texas could go. Georgia could very well go. Arizona, we're looking really, really good right now.
Yeah.
So definitely worth competing and definitely worth building the party. You know, Beto O'Rourke deserves all of our thanks for having built a party and left a legacy from his campaign.
Yeah.
And what we're doing is continuing to build on what's already been there. And there's a reason that we're winning House seats. And we have a shot at winning a Senate seat.
Yeah. And I would say Beto O'Rourke and, you know, by the way, Pete Buttigieg, who I know you supported during the primary. Both of them are great examples of what I was talking about earlier with, you know, winning and doing well in the parts of a conservative state where Democrats can win and using that to show the rest of the state what we can do with Democratic policies. I think there's
By the way, the other thing that's important is not just winning in the parts you can win,
yep,
but not losing badly in the parts you can't win. But there's a difference between losing a rural area 65-35,
yeah,
and losing 80-20.
Yeah.
Tim Kaine in Virginia was always very good at not winning Appalachia. He wasn't going to win there,
yeah,
but not losing badly.
Yeah.
Not being completely unacceptable. Yeah. And much of that is about talking the language of patriotism.
Yeah.
It's about showing decency and dignity and respect. And these are candidates who've done that very, very well.
I'm all for some decency, dignity, and respect back in American politics. It's too bad that it all has to be on one side for now, but you know what? We'll take that burden. Simon, thank you so much. It's been such a delight to talk to you, as always.
Karen, it's absolute joy, and congratulations on the podcast.
Oh, thanks. I love doing it.
Thanks again.
And that's it. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you have enjoyed the podcast, please take the time to leave it a rating or a review. It really is appreciated and it does help. You can always reach me on Twitter. I'm at KarenJR. That's Karen with an I. JR at KarenJR on Twitter. If you are an American listening to the sound of my voice, please, I beg you, I implore you, go forth and register to vote and request your absentee ballot, even if you believe that you are already registered. I'd encourage everyone to try and get an absentee ballot this year if they can. We don't know what the situation is going to be in November with COVID-19. Better safe than sorry. Let's reduce the lines at polling places. Let's make life easier for those who have to vote in person. Let's everybody get ourselves sorted out with an absentee ballot as soon as possible. If you're an American back home in the US, the website you want to go to sort that out is vote.org. Or if you're here overseas like myself as an expat, go to votefromabroad.org. I should let you know that this podcast is not affiliated with any organization or entity. It is just me, and I wish you a very happy week.